And we got fun. Marriage, colon, a supreme earthly test of discipleship. That's my topic. Subtitle, a revolution and a revelation, colon, what love is and what love does. A revolution and a revelation, colon, what love is and what love does. And it is also a theological mystery. Marriage is a theological mystery. Now, number one, and I'm going to give you, well, this is session number one, and there will be three headings under it as we come to those. But before we get to the heading number one, we are now on session number one, which is love gives up itself. Love gives up itself. So it is a look at what love is and what love does. You remember the three conditions of discipleship. There's a very strong link between marriage and discipleship. Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, there are three things that are required. Number one, give up your right to yourself. Number two, take up the cross. And number three, follow. Now, you don't have to be a disciple of Jesus Christ if you don't want to. Jesus said, if you want to. There are plenty of other rabbis around, but if you want to be my disciple, these are the conditions. And if we want godly marriages, these same three conditions apply. Give up your right to yourself, take up the cross, and follow. Take a look at 2 Corinthians 5, 14 and 15. Christ's love compels us because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died. And he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. And surely the most supreme, necessary, what shall I call it? Understanding of marriage must be just exactly the same as Jesus taking this position, that he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves. And it takes us a while sometimes to realize that there has been that tremendous dichotomy, just a sudden cutting off, and we can no longer live for ourselves. Titus 2:14 tells us that Jesus Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. So Jesus Christ gave up himself. That's the whole topic this morning. Love gives up itself. 1 Timothy 2:6, Christ Jesus gave himself as a ransom for all men. Dr. Henry Crabbendam, in his paper, The Biblical Pattern of Preparation for Marriage, says, in Genesis, God shows that there is an irrepressible tendency in the husband to be irresponsible. Selah. It is practically the first thing that Adam displays after his rebellion against God. When asked whether he had eaten of the tree, he points the finger to his wife. God also shows that there is an irrepressible tendency in the wife to be dominating. And how many of us women know that's the truth? We... Not one hand has gone up. I know it's the truth. We want to dominate. And God tells Eve, your desire shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you. The combination of Genesis 3:16, where this phrase occurs, and Genesis 4:7, removes beyond any doubt that God warns Eve that she has this tendency, and Adam that he may not let it go unchecked. And that last part is all Henry Crabbendam's words. This removes all doubt. The combination of Genesis 3:16 and Genesis 4:7 removes beyond any doubt that God warns Eve that she has this tendency, and Adam that he may not let it go unchecked. And I think Adam simply wimped out. And that's a tendency, an irrepressible tendency in every man to be irresponsible. So a realistic view of marriage is one that takes into account and is shaped by an understanding of its profound spiritual character as ordained by Christ. Now that's introductory stuff under session one. Now here is point one. The nature of love. Is it a mood, a feeling, a matter of temperament or of upbringing? Sentiment, emotion? It is none of the above, and it is most certainly not, as that wonderful Scottish preacher Eric Alexander says, a glandular condition. Love is not a glandular condition. It's not a mood, a feeling, a matter of temperament, of upbringing, sentiment, or emotion. In 1 John 3:16, which may not spring to your lips, you all know John 3:16, but maybe not all of you would be able to quote 1 John 3:16. This is how we know what love is, that Christ laid down his life for us. That's what love is. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers, or including us wives, let's say, for each other. And this means, in three simple words, death to the self. The hardest thing that is required of any of us. We have to die. And Paul said, I die daily. He learned that. We're very slow learners, most of us. But we are required to die to ourselves. And 1 John 3:16 is one of the many passages which makes that very clear. Now, how can we do this? By sacrifice. Oblation. The offering up of ourselves. Lord, here I am, all of me for you forever. Do anything you want with me. And as you well know, God has required of me submission, not just to number one or number two, but also to number three. And I hope Lars is the last. But it has been a very different road in each case, because they were three extremely different men. But the same principle applies. Death to the self. And Jim Elliot's definition of marriage is divorce from privacy. You don't have any more privacy. You are not your own. The Bible says you are bought with a price. You see how the links are so obvious between discipleship and marriage? You are no longer your own. And if I didn't get so many hundreds of letters from mostly women telling me about their miserable marriages and expecting me to sort it all out for them, I wouldn't be nearly so aware of how prevalent this is in the most earnest and dedicated Christian homes. Just a very feeble understanding of the nature of love. It is revolutionary. It is a revolution and a revelation. Now, when you think back over your own marriage and your what marriage has been for you since that point, did you think first when you decided to marry this woman or this man, did you think first of the sacrifice that this was going to be for you? Of course not. Here's this wonderful, dazzling creature that suddenly has decided to accept your proposal. And you just think everything's wonderful, but you're certainly not thinking about what a tremendous sacrifice this is going to be. You don't have clue number one to what that sacrifice may be. Did you think about the sacrifices that you were going to make daily for the blessing of your spouse? Probably not. Do you think daily of the sacrifices that he or she makes for you? Or haven't there been any sacrifices? Are you not aware that you ever had to make any sacrifices? If you're not aware, then I would say you're not aware of much of anything, because it does mean sacrifice. It is impossible to love deeply without sacrifice. Any mother has to know that. That's a whole different direction, of course, but that's something that can't be ignored. She bears this child in herself, and she has to go through all kinds of problems in the first 9 months in many cases. I never had that problem at all. I've only had one child, and it was just nothing but fun for those 9 months for me. But I hear other stories of women having to be hospitalized and all sorts of other things. And then, of course, when the moment comes of the actual delivery of that baby, it is agony and it's sacrifice. Surely you can't help but think about it as such. And that's only the beginning. You know that. And that tiny, wonderful, gorgeous little package that is handed to you as a gift from God, do you think at that very moment, this wonderful little creature will someday have the strength to absolutely destroy my thinking about that child? You have no idea what's going to happen because of having this one child. But it means sacrifice. And that child is going to rake your soul with pain somehow, sometime. And I get many, many letters from women telling me that their husbands have decided to leave with the simple statement that I don't love you anymore. That's it. That's a good enough reason to leave. But a Christian marriage, you recognize that you marry because you love this person. But from day one, let's say day two, the day after the wedding, you have to begin to love this person because you married her. My husband and I were at a very fancy wedding in Boston, and at the end they asked for, well, testimonies or whatever at the reception. And so when it was our turn to go up and say something, I simply said to this young man, I said, you are marrying this beautiful woman because you love her, but from tomorrow for the rest of your life, you're going to have to love her because you married her. That should be very clear. Someone has written that Christian love is not the victim of my emotions, but the servant of my will. Christian love is not the victim of my emotions, but the servant of my will. I'm sure that many of you have read C.S. Lewis's Four Loves. I want to read you a passage from that. Let me give you, first of all, 1 Thessalonians 5:10. He died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up. And in what ways are you earnestly and honestly trying to build your spouse up? Well, I feel very sure that I'm speaking to an audience who is earnest and honest about wanting to do these things right, or you wouldn't bother to come. He died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up. And C.S. Lewis says in his book, The Four Loves, speaking about agape and charity, God, who needs nothing, loves into existence wholly superfluous creatures in order that he may love and perfect them. He creates the universe, already foreseeing, or should we say, seeing, there are no tenses in God, the buzzing cloud of flies about the cross, the flayed back pressed against the uneven stake, the nails driven through the mesial nerves, the repeated incipient suffocation as the body droops, the repeated torture of back and arms, as it is time after time, for breath's sake, hitched up. If I may dare the biological image, God is a host who deliberately creates his own parasites, causes us to be that we may exploit and take advantage of him. Herein is love. This is the diagram of love himself, the inventor of all loves. Nobody can say it like Lewis. I would never have been able to describe the buzzing cloud of flies, the flayed back pressed against the uneven stake, the nails driven through the nerves, suffocation, etc. Herein is love. Now let's go to number two, point number two, the glory of sacrifice. The glory of sacrifice. Compare it with discipleship. As the bride is coming down the aisle, just ecstatic, as her eyes are focused only on that gorgeous man down there who is waiting for her, is she sobbing as she walks down the aisle, thinking of all the horrible things that are going to happen once she gets stuck with this guy? Well, of course not. You know, he's the most beautiful person in the world, and this is the most wonderful thing that she's ever wanted, and here it's happening, and her father is in an agony of sweat, and her mother is probably crying her eyes out. But she is not thinking of discipleship, of denying herself and giving up herself and relinquishing and surrendering. But Jesus said, you must love as I have loved you. You must love one another as I have loved you. This is just the beginning. It means sacrifice. And the word must come again and again and again as we think about this. It means sacrifice. A total surrender of something which is laid on the altar, and the results are going to be ashes. That's what a sacrifice ended up being, wasn't it, in the Old Testament? And so when things happen in our lives that seem incomprehensible, and we look at the Lord, look up to the Lord and say, Lord, why? Well, he says, do you think I know what I'm doing? I'm in charge. I've got the whole world in my hands. Love one another as I have loved you, which means sacrifice yourself. Is that a popular notion today? Certainly not. It is the diametrical opposite. How many of you have read Mike Mason's book, Marriage, on marriage? I'm trying to think what the title is. The Mystery of Marriage. Not a hand. Oh, yes. Well, it's a blockbuster. It's not like any other marriage book that I know of, so by all means, run to the nearest store and buy yourself a copy of Mike Mason's The Mystery of Marriage. And he starts right out, the very first chapter, or maybe it's the introduction, I've forgotten, but he finds himself on his honeymoon in a some kind of a Catholic retreat, and whether it's the very first day after the wedding, I can't remember, but he finds himself kneeling in this tiny little chapel with the complete conviction that he was meant to be a monk. Second day of his wedding. It's a very interesting book. Anyway, it's not like any other book that I've ever read. It's not even close, but it is a blockbuster, so I recommend that. So the glory of sacrifice. The bride is not walking down the aisle sobbing. She's not thinking about all the sacrifices that she's going to make. But as someone has said, she is thinking about the expulsive power of a new affection. I think that was my second husband that said that. He was a brilliant philosopher and theologian, and I'm pretty sure I got that from him. And I know I didn't make it up. The expulsive power of a new affection. And so she may not be thinking of sacrifice, but she certainly has some clue that it means surrender, which is what she, with all her heart, wants to do. I want to give myself to my husband. Here I am, all of me for you forever. And that's the most marvelous thing that a wife, that a woman can look forward to. Provided, of course, that she hasn't been sleeping around before. And we can't get into all that, but that is one of the greatest tragedies, that all of this is just played out in utter meaninglessness. Now, engagement, and just this morning I was answering a letter from a young woman who wrote me a thrilling story of how she had just gotten engaged. And I was thinking here, engagement is the most glorious moment when the charter of real freedom is signed. It is when you can't help loving. The citadel has been taken, the heart totally won, the surrender longed for and finally made, and the will breaks forth into spontaneous action, filled with joy at the voluntary choice to surrender. I have no choice but to give myself. I fling myself at your feet and say, take me. And both the man and the woman desire this. I want you, and I want you to have me. I think you'll agree, if you wouldn't necessarily have thought in these particular terms, but I think that's really what it is about. And there's a poem, I heard him call, come follow. That was all. My gold grew dim. My soul went after him. Who would not follow if they heard him call? And that is a poem about Jesus Christ, and that was one of the things that galvanized me to want to be a missionary. And when people asked me, after I became a missionary, why did you come, or how did the call come, I always gave them this little poem. I heard him call, come follow. That was all. My gold grew dim. My soul went after him. Who would not follow if they heard him call? Now compare that with the call of the disciples. They left their nets immediately. We're given absolutely nothing else but the bare bones of what happened. Jesus said, come and follow me, and they left their nets and they followed. They left their nets, they left their work, they left their father. And I always feel so sorry for their father. The Zebedees of the world are the fathers when their children leave. But they did it gladly. They could not possibly know what this was ultimately going to cost them. Tradition tells us that several of the disciples were crucified head down. We don't know whether that's true or not, but at any rate, they hadn't a clue what they were in for when they left their nets. What a quiet, simple life they lived. Hard work, of course, but they were pretty sure they knew what was all about and what they were supposed to do. And they didn't know a thing except that Jesus had called them. They could not know what this was going to cost. Now, few brides or grooms give much thought to sacrifice. If they knew what they're really saying, for better or for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, do they consider the giving up of privacy, of making unilateral decisions, of independence, time, space, a new name, a new geography perhaps? And it was pretty clear to me that Lars was going to take me to Atlanta, Georgia. I certainly didn't want to go to Atlanta, but I wanted that man. And so it was a case of, it's either or. Do you want to accept this man's proposal, or do you want to just stay where you are? And it was not an easy choice, but there was no question in my mind that since God had obviously made it clear to me that I was to marry Lars, then wherever he was going to take me was wherever I had to go. Unilateral decision making. Time, space, name, geography, career, ambition, all of these things ought to be taken into account, but of course usually are not. Not in any very clear way. Number three now, point 3, salted with fire. And I want to read from Mark 9. Mark 9, verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand what he meant, and were afraid to ask him about it. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." "Teacher," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said. "No one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me, for whoever is not against us is for us. I tell you the truth, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to Christ will certainly not lose his reward. And if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around his neck." And how very often Amy Carmichael uses this verse. Many of you, most of you know, I'm sure, about the work of Amy Carmichael in rescuing little children from temple prostitution. And at the peak of her work there in India, there were 700 of these children who otherwise would have had a terrible life of prostitution. And she went over this verse again and again. "If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around his neck." Awesome punishment for anyone who would do such a thing. And when we look at those little children that God gives us, you see the face of God, and how seldom we stop to think about this passage. "If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell, where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and to be thrown into hell. Everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with each other." Now, please don't ask me to explain what that salt means exactly, but it's something that I think the Spirit of God can make real to each of us. Now, as Lars mentioned last night, what we wives thought was a prize package turned into a surprise package. Because it doesn't make any difference how long you may have known a person. There are a whole lot of things which are not going to be revealed until after the wedding. And as Lars made clear to you last night, he lived in my house for 2 years as a lodger. I would sometimes have to go into his room and take my finger and write in the dust on his desk, "Please, dust." And I mean, it was my house and my rules, and I had 2 seminary students there. As Lars told you, one of them became my son-in-law, the other one eventually became my husband. But it was entirely my job and my place. And Lars was the perfect gentleman, and I can say that without any fear of equivocation. Both he and Walt were Southern gentlemen. They knew how to behave. Never once did I ever see Lars angry. Not once in 2 whole years. But rather shortly after the wedding, everything fell apart. I think he's going to tell that story, so I'll leave that for him. My daughter told me that I've often asked women, now, what was the very first conflict after your marriage? It's rather interesting to find out what the answers are. And so my daughter volunteered this information. They went to St. Thomas, I think it was, one of those very fancy islands, and they had no idea how expensive everything was going to be there. I guess Walt had gotten a good deal on the flight over there. But on the very, they had a little cottage where they were going to be doing their own cooking. And so Valerie was just ecstatic to think that they were going to go to the grocery store together. And for the first time, she would be able to pick out all the things that she knew Walt loved. And they started around in that grocery store. And one thing after another that Valerie picked up to put into the cart, Walt looked at the price. And he said, "No way!" Stuck it back where it was. And they went all the way around. She said, before we got halfway around, I was just in tears because he wasn't allowing me to buy anything because it was so very expensive. And so she said, you know, Mama, I had never seen Walt sin. Never. They also had known each other for, I think, 2.5 years, maybe almost 3 years, because Walt was 9 years older than Val. And he had graduated from seminary, and she was still in college. And so she said, Mama, I never saw Walt sin until that morning after the honeymoon. And she said he just got so angry and so livid, she just was realizing this was a surprise package. She had no idea that this was possible. Now you can share some of your stories with your tables later in the day about your first conflict in marriage. And Ad and I went to the Plaza Hotel in New York for our honeymoon. My brother Tom lived just a few blocks away from there, so they put on the reception for us, and we were married in a little church on Park Avenue around the corner from where my brother lived. And on that very first night, we went to this hotel, and my husband, this was about, I suppose, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that we got there, and he just threw himself down on the bed and said he was going to take a little nap. And I sat down to the writing table to write a letter to my daughter. My daughter had been my maid of honor, and she had been taken by a dear friend of mine back up to New Hampshire where we lived. And so I wanted to write her a letter. And as I was writing the letter, I glanced every once in a while over to Ad, and I began to feel that there was something very weird going on. I mean, he was upset about something, and I couldn't imagine what it was, but I just went on, wrote the letter. When I finished, he decided it was time to go down and eat dinner. And as we sat at the dinner table, there was just a very strange sort of barrier there. And finally, I just said to him, is something wrong? He said, well, of course. You mean you don't know what's wrong? I said, no, I have no idea. Well, he said, you just sat down at that table and you just started writing a letter to your daughter and you never said a word to me about it. You didn't tell me what you were going to do. I thought, my goodness, why in the world would he even be interested to know what I was doing? Just a tiny little thing like that just ruined that evening. So, surprise package again. Well, as with marriage, so with discipleship. The glory of sacrifice is quickly dimmed as we begin to learn its reality. The bedroom, the bathroom, the breakfast table, and the budget. Am I ringing any bells out there? The bedroom, the bathroom, the breakfast table, and the budget. The 4 B's, terrible things. When push comes to shove, and we realize that we are not willing to give up all our rights, we are going to be salted with fire. wherever the beloved goes necessitates a daily, costly, continuous revolution. If in premarital counseling some of these sacrifices were delineated, each one could prepare his list to present at the feet of Jesus. Thus the marriage would begin with sacrifice, an act of faith and trust in God, who will help to fulfill the impossible vows, the impossible, quotation marks, vows. One must try it in order to know the riches of faith, of discipleship, and of marriage. As someone has said, we would love to have the splendor of self-offering. I think this was G.K. Chesterton. We want the splendor of self-offering without the sacrifice of self-denial. We want the splendor of self-offering without the sacrifice of self-denial. The self quickly rises up with its, quote, reasonable and legitimate claims. And we begin to know ourselves in a way that would have been impossible otherwise. Because in most cases, there is a very wide gap between the way the man was raised at home and the way the woman was raised. There are all kinds of surprises that come. And ourselves, the self in us, quickly rises up, thinking that we have legitimate claims. Many of you know the lovely hymn, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." One of the stanzas says, "Take myself and I will be ever only all for thee." How greatly it would help us if we would learn the great hymns of the faith. I can't tell you what a blessing the hymns have been in my life, and that comes because our parents taught us hymns. Now, please don't think that I'm against the praise songs that many churches use entirely without using hymns at all. But the Bible says there are psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, three different kinds of Christian music. And unfortunately, in many of the churches that we visit, we find out that there's only one of those three that are paid any attention to. And here's Francis Ridley Havergal, who wrote very many of those great hymns, saying, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." She was never married, but her consecration to Christ was total. "Take myself and I will be ever only all for thee." Every morning after breakfast, we children were herded into the living room. Either my father or my mother sat down to the piano, and we would sing a hymn, and we would sing all the stanzas. Consequently, all of us know, I don't think I would be exaggerating if I said all of us could probably recite from memory 100 hymns with all the stanzas. And that tremendous, rich giving that comes from those great old hymns has been one of the things that has helped me in my times when I'm being salted with fire. "If thou but suffer God to guide thee and hope in him through all thy ways, he'll do thee good, whate'er betide thee, and bear thee through the evil days. Who trusts in God's unchanging love, builds on a rock that naught can move." Sing, pray, I've forgotten the next word, but something about "do thine own part faithfully, trust his rich promises of grace, so shall they be fulfilled in thee. God never yet forsook in need the soul that trusteth him indeed." I think my very first loves of those hymns were the hymns that talked about the cross. When I was just a little child, I loved "Beneath the Cross of Jesus." I think that was my favorite. And there's a stanza in there that is omitted from so many of the hymn books. And it says, "O safe and happy shelter, O refuge tried and sweet, O trysting place where heaven's love and heaven's justice meet. As to the holy patriarch," and surely Elizabeth Clefane, the author, was thinking of Jacob and his ladder, As to the holy patriarch, a wondrous dream was given. So seems my Savior's cross to me, a ladder up to heaven. I take, O cross, thy shadow for my abiding place. I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of his face. Now that is a staggering commitment, isn't it? To say, I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of his face. We need to remember that when we're very angry with somebody that we happen to live with. I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of his face, content to let the world go by, to know no gain or loss, my sinful self, my only shame, my glory, all the cross. Then there's so many that have the cross. In the cross of Christ, I glory, towering o'er the wrecks of time. All the light of sacred story gathers round its head sublime. And Jesus, keep me near the cross. There a precious fountain, free to all, a healing stream flows from Calvary's mountain. And if we could put ourselves deliberately, honestly, and completely at the foot of the cross every day, there would be no marital problems. God would show us the way to love this person. And so I go over the 3 points again. The nature of love, not merely a mood or a feeling or a matter of temperament and upbringing and sentiment and emotion or a glandular condition. It is a choice. The nature of love, a revolution and a revelation. Number two, the glory of sacrifice. And number three, salted with fire. May the Spirit of Christ dwell in us. God bless you.